This is Gary Williams from the EFTWorldHub.com, and I'm speaking to Sue Beer. Hello, Sue.
Hello there.
And we have spoken before, haven't we?
We have indeed. And lovely to speak with you again.
Yeah, and we shared a few things about EFT. And today we're having a tribute to Gary Craig. What are your memories of Gary Craig himself?
My overriding memory of Gary is actually his sense of humour.
Right.
And his enormous playfulness and friendliness. He's a lovely, lovely guy to be around.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the reasons why he's been able to so successfully kind of spread the message of EFT because of his own larger than life personality.
Yeah, and he's really kind of pushed EFT forward, hasn't he, in that sense?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I think that what he's been able to do is communicate a message, which is marketing, but in a very positive sense. He's been able to spread the word, communicate a message, and he's done that because people have identified with who he is. I think he's got the kind of, you know, ability to say something that people haven't heard before, but at the same time to be kind of non-threatening and you know, friendly, and that's very, very attractive to people, I think.
Right, and he makes it interesting.
Absolutely, yeah, interesting and fascinating. I think those are his particular skills and the way that he communicates.
And you've spent time on stage with him, haven't you, from time to time?
Yeah, in particular, well, the first time that I met him was actually at one of the Serious Diseases workshops. That was in Dallas. And the first time that I kind of met him and got to know him personally was when we did the master's assessment, the one that was held in the UK in Barton, Humberside. And that was the very, very first time that we got to kind of, you know, be alongside him and see some of his vulnerability as well as his strengths. And I had the absolutely wonderful opportunity of actually working on him as my client during the master's assessment. So that's kind of one of the things that stands out in my memory as being, you know, a wonderful experience, really.
Right. And what did you take away from your experience with being, you know, with him? What was there something that you took away in that sense?
to be honest with you, what it was an absolute conviction of the power of these techniques, of the tapping techniques, because having that experience of actually working on Gary, it's kind of like, you know, in a sense, in your worst nightmares, you might not want to do that, but to do it and then to see the, you know, to see how powerful it is in the response of another person, the person that has created this whole idea and communicated the message of it. It's quite difficult to put into words. It was almost like sort of time stood still, and I just had a very, very deep sense of this maybe isn't all of the picture that's like unfolding in front of us, you know, this whole tapping thing, but it's a very, very important step along the way.
Right.
I knew that anyway, otherwise I wouldn't have been interested enough to go for the master's program and, you know, and absolutely commit to everything that involved. But there was just something about that particular encounter that was, you know, that was deeply profound for me personally, and will stay with me. And I think it's also left me with a sense. What I'm trying to say really is that there's more to come.
Right.
That you know, really back to the, you know, we were on the ground floor of the healing high rise. There's an awfully long way to go with this, and it's all very, very fascinating and exciting.
Mm. As I say, it's the journey that's important, isn't it? Not the getting
there. It is.
There.
Yeah. Yeah. It is the journey, and as soon as you start thinking that, you know, that you've got somewhere, or that's it, that's the final moment, that there's nothing else to learn, then that's the point where really you stop growing, I think.
Right. And that was kind of an aha moment for you, but what was the aha moment you had that really got you involved in EFT itself?
It wasn't so much a kind of personal aha moment. When I was first introduced to EFT, I just literally saw a kind of video clip of it on the internet with Adrienne. Do you remember Adrienne that worked with Gary in the early days?
Yeah.
on the you know, the early DVDs and videos and stuff. And it was a clip of her working with somebody with a blood phobia,
Right.
And it was probably only a few minutes long, and it was shown to me in the context of a hypnotherapy supervision session. And the question was, you know, what do you think is happening here? What, you know, how is this working? Because it was clearly working. You could see that the person was going from, you know, a sort of terror at just the thought of blood to, you know, complete freedom by the end of the few minutes session. And I've always been interested in what works. You know, how are we kind of maintaining ourselves in a problem state, or how are we keeping ourselves from happiness or kindness to one another, those kind of things. And so I was absolutely gripped with wanting to know how this was working. You know, and initially I was trying to put it in the context of what I already knew from my training in you know, hypnotherapy and NLP and psychotherapy, and I couldn't quite work it out then, and I'm still trying to work it out now, really.
Right. And what is your passion now for EFT? Where is it taking you?
Where it's taking me now is sort of deeper and deeper into exploring the power of the mind and how the mind works, how much we're governed by unconscious influences, unconscious thinking, and how when we heal, what was previously unconscious tends to come more into our conscious awareness, and we're able to kind of get a communication going between the different levels of mind. I think somehow or other the tapping allows us to kind of create a bridge between our unconscious thinking and our conscious mind, and at some level we kind of agree to, you know, release some of those things, those ideas, thoughts, beliefs, problem states that have held us back in the past. I don't know how that works necessarily, but the tapping seems to bridge between different levels of mind or different levels of consciousness, and this is what I'm getting more and more interested in, I think, really.
Right.
As it relates to all kinds of problems.
Is that along the lines of even getting to the point where we don't need to tap as such?
Yeah, I think maybe it is. You know, many people have sort of played around with what, you know, when can we miss out tapping points? You know, seemingly we can frequently miss out tapping points and still get the same results. We can play around. We can use our intuition to tap points in a different order. None of those things seem to be as important, maybe as kind of setting. I think when we decide to tap, we kind of set our intention to sort of pause the problem state or pause the problem thinking. Now, in a sense, that's what we're doing when we put it, when we use that, you know, the setup of, okay, I have this problem, you know, and I deeply and completely love and accept myself. So it's like we're sort of creating a bridge between the conscious thinking, which is where the problem state exists,
right,
and an unconscious level where, you know, we're able to access our, you know, complete freedom from any kind of problem state. And when we do that, it's like a, you know, we're interrupting the old pattern and allowing something else to come in to influence the process of change.
Right.
And whether we'll get, you know, whether that's the important thing, that we set our minds to think in that way. As opposed to actually the tapping being the important thing, I'm not sure.
Do you believe that, though, you know, you're going to have to learn the basics and then progress to be able to get to a point where you can stop tapping, if you like?
Yes, I do. I think that the most important thing is to learn the basics, the foundations of EFT so thoroughly that it kind of frees you up to allow your creativity and intuition to roll. And that seems to be what happens when you learn this in, you know, bite-sized chunks, piece by piece by piece, in exactly the way that Gary has laid down through his video trainings. I don't think that anything has replaced Gary's foundational trainings yet, and I think that they are such a valuable resource. I think that they're enormously important.
Right, and you're probably like me. You probably did the 9 hours or however long it was on each one, and
absolutely,
drove everyone,
900 hours, I should think.
Yeah, and drove everyone crazy in the process.
Yeah, exactly, with the music, you know, coming on and everybody groaning. I'm going, oh, no, not that again.
Yeah, so you weren't divorced or anything by the end of that, so...
Not yet.
No. Yeah. So where do you see EFT actually going now for the future?
That is such an interesting question. Where will it go now? I think that the potential for it is absolutely limitless as more and more areas kind of become involved. I think that we will see change. I think we will see huge changes in medicine over the next few years. You know, maybe as long as the next 5, 10, 20 years. I think that there's a whole shift coming in, and that the tapping can be enormously, enormously useful. We just see that when we're training people, we're beginning to get more and more GPs coming to train with us, more and more hospital doctors coming to train with us, a kind of, you know, a newer, younger, possibly more open-minded group of people that are coming through, for whom, well, they're going to have the personal experience of understanding the power of the tapping techniques, and then inevitably want to apply that in their own work. So there's going to be, you know, huge changes as that grows. Anything that works grows. It just, you know, it has to. So I think that will happen in medicine. I think that will happen in education, and I think it will happen in the way that we're bringing up our families, the way that we're educating our children, and, you know, and treating our children, and having relationships with our children.
I think
it will change the world over the next, you know, few years. We'll see that more and more. I really do.
Right. And do you think it will become a household name as such?
Yes, I do. I think I'm not sure, you know, whether the terms, you know, tapping or EFT or energy psychology, whether those will last, but I think that it has initiated a change in the way that we think. This is kind of going back to the way, you know, what I was saying at the beginning point about the tapping, because of being a bridge between old thinking and new thinking, if you like. And I think ultimately that is what is going to be changed. That's going to be what changes the way that we live. Possibly the terms will pass, will fade, will become something else. I'm not sure.
Right. I know in the United Kingdom we've had people like Paul McKenna, haven't we, using what he calls tapping, which is really,
yes,
TFT,
yes,
and EFT, really, in a sense.
Yes, exactly. But, I mean, he's certainly not using the terms EFT tapping. He's using the kind of generic term. Sorry, he's not using the terms EFT or TFT. He's
right.
Using the, you know, generic term tapping. If he even mentions what it's called, he's kind of incorporating it into his work. But he's showing the power of its effectiveness. He's showing the results, and that's what attracts people. And then means that the people that experience that get a change on the inside, and then they're changed fundamentally, and they contribute that in the way that they, you know, live their lives and conduct themselves in the world. So, you know, it's all about kind of change on the inside, and then that's reflected in the outer world, I think.
So there's a lot of new people coming into EFT, and what kind of advice would you give to them, you know, when they're just getting involved with EFT for the first time?
My advice would be to learn the basics thoroughly. You know, I think the biggest mistake that people make is to kind of assume that this is so simple that that they know everything, having learnt, you know, the tapping points, which I guess you can do in about 10 minutes. There is much more to this than there appears to be on the surface. And I think if you skip out those sort of fundamentals, the absolute basic mechanics, then it will kind of, you know, it will cut you short in your progress at some point.
Right, because a lot of people see people like Brad Yates and Carol Look just tapping away and not really using the basic recipe anymore, and they probably ask, well, you know, why do we have to go through all this, you know, three rounds of this and do the eye roll and everything else?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think that, you know, and the answer is that you just don't get to be where Brad Yates and Carol Look are without learning the basics first, you know. I know Carol Carol will be the first person to say that, you know, that she learned the principles, you know, step by step by step. But, you know, the great joy of that is that, you know, we're not really talking about a great long haul. You know, you can learn the tapping points in 10 minutes and begin to get changes and results from there. But it's more about keeping an openness of mind, which means that you don't think that you've become, you know, you've achieved excellence in the first 10 minutes. And I think the people that are really, really most skilled with this have that attitude of, you know, of continual learning.
Right. And does it take time really to, you know, to get as good as, you know, people like Carol and other people?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know, and I know that, you know, Carol is continually refining her work. She's learning all the time, and that's the way that she approaches it. That's her mindset, and that's what makes her brilliant, really, I think.
Right. And what are you focusing on at the moment?
I'm developing my work sort of particularly in the area of working with addictions, healing from addictions, and personal transformation that can come about through recovery. I'm currently working on my book, which is Healing the Addicted Heart, the Five Stages of Transformation. So it's a whole kind of journey from the state of addiction, whether that's to, you know, substance or relationships or some kind of behavior or way of thinking,
right,
to a life of freedom and happiness and joy. So it's not something that's a quick fix. It's really about this continual learning, openness of mind, and you know, even when we've quit the addiction, stop doing the thing that's you know, that's been tripping us up for, you know, however long that might be, the point is to really open ourselves up to, you know, continually learning how we can increase the amount of joy and happiness and usefulness that we have in our lives. So
these
are things that really fascinate me. It's you know, I know through using the tapping and other techniques that it's relatively easy to kind of stop problem behaviors, including addiction. You know, the question is how do we maintain that freedom from it, and you know, what do we need to do, what are the different, you know, levels of change that we need to approach, and how do we cultivate, you know, a mindset that really thoroughly is open to continual change and growth.
Right. I mean, addictions can be very destructive, can't they? Or some kinds of addictions.
Yeah, hugely. Yeah, hugely. I think, you know, any time that we get, you know, hooked into a particular thing, you know, whether it's a substance or a way of you know, of thinking, I mean, just continually experiencing anger, you can think of that as an addictive state. You know, if every time something happens to you, you respond with anger, you know, you're stuck in that mindset, you're stuck in that problem state. And you know, some addictive states, you know, such as, you know, a heroin addiction or crack cocaine or something like that, will be obviously kind of destructive, and you know you may lose your home, job, those kind of things. But I think that many addictive states are kind of insidiously destructive.
And you think,
things like smoking, for instance, which, you know, most of the time it doesn't stop people kind of living a life. You know, it doesn't stop you going to work. It doesn't stop you, you know, being married or having a relationship. But in a sense, it does. It limits our potential. And if you get really, really into that whole thing of you know, wanting to stop smoking and not being able to do it, you know, you can end up with a very, very kind of small, limited, paralyzed way of existing. But it's kind of, you know, it's more insidious. And I think that whole thing applies to even things like, you know, internet and computer games and things that you know, like going to the gym, which we might think of as being positive. They're all forms of limitation.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of good being done, you know, in the work of addictions. But I often hear phrases like, you know, getting clean and stuff like that, which in a sense would imply that the person's kind of dirty in the first place. And
yeah.
It just doesn't really, for me, it doesn't feel a comfortable way of describing people, if that makes sense.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that there's a lot of that sort of fear-based thinking. You know, people do talk in terms of, oh, well, you know, I'm 56 days clean, and I'm 3 months sober, and those kind of things. You know, as if the sort of the hanging on to the not doing the thing is the end of the story, and it, actually it's not. It kind of still keeps you attached to that whole thinking that in order to not do something, what do you have to do? You have to think of it in the first place.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The work that I'm doing is trying to sort of figure out, you know, how we can completely move away from that fear-based thinking and possibly see how addictions are giving us a positive message. You know, how can we take that in the same sense that you can often, well, these days with a shift in thinking, think about physical illnesses as being the thing that led you on to a new life of greater freedom, greater honesty, greater integrity and joy. And I think, I think the same thing is with addictions, but if we still keep looking back and focusing on what was and think that the only important thing is to not do the thing anymore,
right,
then we're really, really missing out on the opportunity that the problem state can be giving to us.
I mean, I think I could get myself into a lot of trouble, and because like with talking about alcohol and the expression of I'm an alcoholic, and I can't get my head around that, but maybe I'm naive. I don't know. I mean, what's your views on that?
Well, I have to say I agree. I mean, we do have to be careful here, because to say that we don't want to use the label I am an alcoholic is not the same thing as saying to people, you might as well go out and drink then. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so like,
yeah.
What it is making a shift in our thinking so that, I am an alcoholic, which applies a sort of state, an immovable state, which isn't open to change. Whereas in fact, alcoholism is a series of behaviors. It's a process of things that you do. So if you begin to sort of examine what it is exactly that you're doing, that you're thinking, you're feeling, you're believing in your life that is adding up to this particular problem state, that gives you an awful lot of material that you can use the tapping to begin to undo.
Right.
Just slapping the label, I'm an alcoholic and I need to hang on, with white knuckles, to prevent myself from taking another drink is not particularly useful. It doesn't take you down the path of, a true solution.
Right. And before before you were a drinker as such, you would have been an okay human being. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Can you not return to that state kind of thing?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You may have been an okay kind of person who had some particular ways of thinking, feeling, and believing about yourself that created internal conflict that then led you on to need to, tranquilize yourself with the alcohol or whatever. So that you've got to get back to really examine what's going on underneath the behavior. In the way, the behavior is flagging up the problem. The behavior is going, help me, get me out of here. I'm not working right.
Yeah. And I know that alcoholics tend to group together, don't they? And they may even have special groups that they talk to each other about that. But can that be a negative thing in the sense of just encouraging the problem even more? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it can be. I think any form of kind of getting together and a bunch of depressives getting together and talking about being depressed is not necessarily particularly helpful.
I think that in
any group of people meeting like that, however, there will be some people who are kind of modelling transformation or modelling positive change.
Right.
And, as with anything, if we go into it and we seek out what's the same as ourselves in either a negative or a positive sense, then that's kind of what we get more of. So
right.
I think I don't want to say that groups like that are no good whatsoever, because I think that thing of companionship, and I think one of the AA phrases is, I can't remember the exact phrase, they have lots of sort of mantras and things, but it's something like, if you go along and stop talking and start listening,
right,
you know, the meaning being that if you're open to it, there will be things that you can learn, there will be examples shown to you that can lead you out, and the whole thing of kind of companionship,
right.
I think, is a very, very important one in the early stages of recovery.
And so, would that depend then on who's conducting it and the manner in which they're doing that?
I think so, and I think. That one of the things that needs to be avoided is kind of, you know, creating another dependency where, you know, the group kind of substitutes for, you know, the old substance, but still limits the person's life in some way. You know, for instance, I mean, if you're spending sort of 4 hours a day going to meetings and you're not able to sort of function without doing that, then, you know, I would question whether the sort of the underlying drivers that created the addiction or the need to, you know, self-medicate in the first place have actually been resolved.
Right. So, but just taking one step at a time, really, though, and moving through the process of that.
Maybe, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I think that, you know, the 12-step groups can be enormously, enormously useful.
Right.
Because they can create a kind of, you know, a new community where if somebody's been absolutely stuck in a drinking community where everybody that they know does that and their whole life revolves around that, stepping into something which doesn't have that initially is entirely positive. You know, it may become negative if it kind of creates another dependency and we're not able to kind of, you know, bridge from that into you know, changing our ways of thinking that have created the problem in the first place.
Right. Well, we can see here, can't we, that this subject is a huge subject, isn't it?
Oh, it's a massive subject. Yeah, you know, it really is. But I mean, the positive thing is that it's a massive, massive subject, and it's one that has many, many different layers and different stages. But the tapping can be used in support of, you know, whatever stage that you're at, whether it's the sort of first desperate days where you don't know what to do and where to turn, or whether it's sort of, you know, months, years into the whole process of change. And, you know, as inevitably happens in life, something comes up which we're not sort of fully able to deal with, and it can throw us back into, you know, old patterns, and, you know, new challenges present themselves because we create more opportunities. So I don't see where we can't use the tapping. It's something that can be like a really, really lifelong friend once you get into it.
Yeah. Well, Sue, if you're open to it, we'll have to drag you back here to do some more on the addiction. So I think it's so important, isn't it? There's so many people out there that are suffering.
It would be my joy to come back and do that. That would be great. Thank you.
People may know people, mightn't they, and be able to share the information as well.
Absolutely.
And also, if they're working in that area, it's important to, you know, get some information, isn't it, on how best to work in that way.
Yes.
Well, we'll certainly make a date for that. Before we go, though, just some last thoughts on Gary Craig and EFT and the tribute, and, you know, where we're going to go in the future, etc.
I think where we're going is somewhere very exciting. I think we're going somewhere that we haven't really been yet, and I feel very, very positive about the possibilities for this.
Right.
I just think that there's something in working with the tapping and the energy techniques for everybody, and it's about each of us kind of fulfilling our potential.
And any last thoughts about Gary Craig himself?
You know, my enduring thinking about Gary is just that I love what he's done. I love the work that he's given to us and he's given to the world. And thank you, Gary.
Well, thanks very much also to you, Sue, for sparing the time to talk to us.
You're very welcome.
And we'll have to come back and talk to you again and get some more information on addictions and all the other work that you do as well.
Great. Look forward to it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sue.